It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up later, we'll learn more about the history of the Natural Areas Movement in the United States and the conservationist who led the charge.
First, Assembly Democrats have started a new gun safety coalition as a way to challenge less stringent gun control laws being approved in the state. The lawmakers will be joined by several groups, including the Wisconsin Anti-Violence Effort and the Wisconsin Council on Churches, as a way to bring gun control reform to the state legislature.
Representative Lisa Subek joins us now. She represents Wisconsin's 78th Assembly District in the Madison area and is a member of the new Wisconsin Coalition for Gun Safety. Representative Subek, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we'll get into the goals of this coalition in just a bit, but first, why now?
Why now? Well, you know, and no better time than the present. Across the country and here in our state, we have seen gun violence reach an epidemic proportion. And so in so many ways, the time is now. You know, there's no one incident or no one thing that happened that made this the right time, but we are hearing here in the Capitol from our constituents and from groups that they are fed up with gun violence, and it's time to put an end to it. And it really was sort of an optimal moment in time for groups and individuals to come together and put together this coalition that will be working to advance good policy and public education and a number of other things to start to eliminate gun violence in our community.
Who is on board in this coalition?
Sure. So the coalition is actually a group that is made up of many disciplines. You know, we have some state representatives and state senators on board with the coalition. Myself, Therese Brousseau, Melissa Sargent, Senator LaTanya Johnson. But the coalition is also, and perhaps most importantly, made up of groups of physicians, domestic violence advocates, social workers, clergy, the Council of Churches, Physicians for Social Responsibility. You know, we have a number of organizations that represent a number of different disciplines or groups, and I think that is so important because if we are going to solve the problem of gun violence, it is going to take people from all walks of life and with all versions of expertise on public health and safety to get involved and really make a difference.
What's your top priority from a legislative standpoint? What law would you like to see changed?
Sure. So yesterday we actually reintroduced a bill that has been introduced in a few different legislative sessions that would require background checks for every gun purchase in the state. And this is good common sense legislation, certainly a really good first priority for this group to work on. You know, across the board, across the country, Republicans, Democrats alike, urban, rural, you go across all demographics, and people support common sense background checks for gun purchases so the guns don't end up in the hands of people who are intent on doing harm to others or to themselves.
What kind of gun purchases are currently done without background checks?
Sure. So currently, background checks are required for gun purchases made through a federally licensed dealer. But if a gun purchase is not made through a federally licensed dealer, then it does not require a background check. So if somebody puts an ad on, on a website or out in a paper that they're selling their gun and someone else purchases it for them, no background check required. At gun shows, people who don't work through federally licensed dealers would be able to make arrangements to sell guns outside of that. You know, a lot of these purchases are actually happening on the internet. There are websites similar to Facebook, not Facebook, but websites that are set up specifically for gun sales, things like Arms List that are modeled after sort of a Facebook or Craigslist-style website that connect people who want to sell guns to each other in our communities. And it's really frightening because every one of those sales and exchanges happens without a background check if it's not made through a federal dealer.
One concern people have raised is, okay, but how about within a family, a parent transferring a gun to a child or a grandparent to a grandchild, something like that?
You know, I think that it's always good to err on the side of public safety. I mean, you know, gun violence has become a public health crisis in our communities. And while certainly we may be able to think up a couple of exemptions that might make sense, those are things that we can consider as a bill moves forward. At this point, what we've encountered here in the state capitol is Republicans are unwilling to even hold a hearing on a bill around background checks. So we can't get to the point of looking at that level of detail from a lawmaking perspective unless Republicans are willing to join Democrats and all of these advocacy groups and their own constituents, quite frankly, in taking a stand and holding a hearing on the background check bill.
By and large, gun rights advocates and Republicans and others who support their goals say, hey, this is a Second Amendment right. We should be moving toward more freedom, more right to bear arms, and be very careful about any step away from it. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I think it's sad that Republicans in the legislature have become more beholden to the NRA and the money they spend in elections and the gun manufacturers and the money that passes down through the NRA for election spending. And as a result, we've seen these Republican lawmakers becoming more beholden to the NRA than their own constituents. The reality is, even among the NRA's members, which are some of the most strident gun rights supporters out there, even among their own membership, polling has shown that their membership supports reasonable, common sense background checks for gun purchases. This should be a no-brainer.
Talking to Representative Lisa Subek of Wisconsin's 78th Assembly District, looking at a new coalition on gun safety that she has helped to found. Representative Subek, outside of the legislature now, outside of laws and ordinances, are there other steps that you and other coalition members are hoping to take to reduce the impact of gun violence, whether we're talking about homicide or suicide?
Absolutely, Rob. I mean, there is so much that this coalition can do and plans to do as it moves forward beyond just under the dome of the Capitol. You know, this coalition will be focusing on community engagement, engaging community members, reaching out across our cities, our towns, our communities to engage people on this issue and to really do some public education in that way. You know, so much of preventing gun violence is not just done through passing good common sense laws, but it is also done through education. It's done through that legislative action. And, of course, policy reform and bringing people together. I think one of the really neat and unique things about this coalition is this isn't just a coalition of individuals who have typically been involved in gun safety or limiting gun violence. You know, we include here clergy, the Wisconsin Council of Churches, physicians, people who come from a number of different disciplines who can bring their expertise to the table in helping us figure out how we end this epidemic.
And are their top priorities, again, non-legislative ways to do that? Is there a focus for that kind of education and engagement you're talking about?
Sure. As a new coalition, the coalition is still developing how exactly it will do each of those things, but it is absolutely a priority. I mean, the coalition really did set sort of four key methods by which they wish to reduce gun violence: community engagement, legislative action, policy reform, and collaboration. And so looking at those four arenas, the coalition is developing specifics of how it will move forward in each of those areas. And certainly on the legislative action side, the background check bill is a good place for the coalition to start.
And outside of those legislative areas, are there places where you think there can be a bipartisan cooperation?
I believe so. You know, I believe that, and certainly, it's not just I believe, the polling has shown us, and information out there has shown us that the Republicans here in the legislature are not, their views are not reflective always of the views of their constituents. And Republicans and Democrats alike are afraid and are concerned. You know, when we hear about every time we turn on the news a school shooting or a shooting in a park or a suicide by gun, we are all impacted by that. It doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. It doesn't matter if you live in a rural or an urban area. Whether you live in a part of the state that's heavily Republican or heavily Democratic, everybody wants to know they and their families and their children can live and work and go to school in a safe environment. And really, at the core, this coalition is about bringing people together who want to ensure that our families can move forward in a safe community, who can have the opportunities that safety affords them.
We'll leave it there for now. Representative Subek, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
Representative Lisa Subek represents Wisconsin's 78th Assembly District in the Madison area. She joined us today to talk about a new gun safety coalition. First, here in Wisconsin, we're familiar with the work of many conservationists. Aldo Leopold, Gaylord Nelson, Sigurd Olsen are a few names that pop to mind. But our next guest says there's another name that should be right up there with all of them.
If you've been to a state natural area recently, you've got George Fell to thank. The Rockford, Illinois native was instrumental in the effort to preserve lands too small to qualify as state or national parks. To put that in perspective, consider that Wisconsin now has nearly 700 state natural areas.
While Fell made a big impact on conservation, his story has by and large remained hidden until now, thanks to our next guest, who's written a history of Fell and his efforts to preserve many of the lands that we enjoy today.
Arthur Melville Pearson joins us now. He's the director of the Chicago program at the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, which helps protect and restore natural lands in the Chicago region. His new book is called Force of Nature, George Fell, founder of the Natural Areas Movement. Arthur, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to talk to you guys.
Well, we have this list of names in Wisconsin that we think of when we think of great conservationists, environmentalists, names like Aldo Leopold, Gaylord Nelson, and Sigurd Olsen. But you also say that the name George Fell should be right there at the top of that list. Why?
Well, actually, there's a pretty good connection between Aldo Leopold and George Fell. So George Fell actually had the chance to study with Leopold at the University of Wisconsin, and for a few different reasons, he chose not to do that but study at the University of Michigan. But while he was there, he was an acolyte of Leopold. He read everything that Leopold ever published. In his master's thesis, he quoted Leopold liberally, shall we say. But as Fell moved through his career, there was a critical difference that happened between Leopold and Fell, and that is Leopold felt that all of these small, scattered natural areas that were still left, primarily in the Midwest, that it wasn't possible for the government to protect and preserve them because they were too small and too scattered. George Fell actually felt differently. Leopold even went so far as to say that they were relegated to extinction. But George Fell, through being incredibly tenacious over the course of 20 years, actually helped pass legislation in the state of Illinois to get these lands protected permanently by establishing what was called the Illinois Nature Preserves Commission.
Well, I want to go back a little bit and talk about George Fell's early life. With a lot of the conservationists that we talk about, they have these important childhoods spent in nature where nature becomes almost an imprint on their psyche and who they are and who they become. Did George Fell have that too?
He absolutely did. So George's father was a prominent psychiatrist, but what he most loved to do was to collect plants. He would go on all these plant collecting trips in Winnebago County, which is where they lived in the city of Rockford. So he was an amateur botanist, but highly respected. Matter of fact, he wrote the Flora of Winnebago County, documenting all the plants native to this Illinois county. But he was not, in George's estimation, a very warm or loving father. But when you look back at George's reflections upon his father, you really get the sense that George developed his love for the native plants of Illinois, in part to be close to his dad.
And it sounds as though George in particular loved the Rock River and that area there.
He really did. As a matter of fact, he loved the Rock River so much and he loved his father so much that when his father passed away, without telling anybody, he fought tooth and nail to protect a very rare gravel hill prairie along the Rock River, and it was one of his father's favorite places to botanize. And again, George being tenacious as he was, it took about 10, 15 years to protect the land, but today it's dedicated and protected permanently as the Harlem Hills Nature Preserve along the Rock River.
And George Fell, it sounds like he didn't set out early on to pursue a career in conservation. He, for instance, ended up working in a series of civilian public service camps during World War II. Can you talk about that kind of intermediary time of his life?
Yeah, George, he loved native plants, but he really didn't know what exactly he wanted to do. And back then, in order to be a conservationist, you would typically go to, for instance, the Yale School of Forestry and become a typical forester. There wasn't a way to protect these small lands, and George really didn't know what he wanted to do. And while he was sort of idling away his time, he was actually drafted into World War II. But rather than fighting in World War II, he became a conscientious objector. So he spent nearly the entire war in a series of civilian public service camps. And the work that he did there, first and foremost, was about soil erosion. So that might not sound like a real sexy thing, but that was soon after the Dust Bowl in the 1930s when a lot of farmland was lost because of these swirling winds and poor agricultural practices. So George spent a lot of the war years trying to correct those agricultural practices to restore the land, and he really got to know about doing that during those civilian public service years.
And when did George Fell hit that pivot point where he realized that he was deeply invested in the preservation of natural areas and that that was how he wanted to direct his passion and his energies?
Sure. Well, once he got out of the civilian public service after the war, there was a building boom. And, boy, development just went into hyperdrive everywhere, including Rockford, where George lived. And George would be so disappointed to see these little patches of prairie and wetlands and woodlands just be gobbled up for the next wave of development. So he was, in his own words, appalled by that, and he wanted to do something. But just as importantly, again, not knowing exactly what he was going to do, he happened to meet his wife, or his future wife. So Barbara Garst and he got together, and quickly it became an alliance between the two of them. And they really became this husband and wife team dedicated together to protecting lands. And the day they got married, they actually spent their honeymoon night on one of those gravel hill prairies along the Rock River. So they kind of consummated their wedding, if you will, amongst all these beautiful wildflowers. And that kind of just set the stage and set the course for the next 50 years that they worked together to protect all these lands.
We're talking with Arthur Melville Pearson right now. He's the author of Force of Nature, George Fell, founder of the Natural Areas Movement. And let's move on to the policy and the preservation that he and sounds like his wife helped to bring about. So this idea of state-sponsored preservation beyond state parks and forests, how was that idea? How did that go over with policymakers and peers at the time?
Well, at first, not very well. George wanted to save all these small areas, and he began a big push to get legislation passed in the state of Illinois. And he spent several years doing that. But there wasn't the money, there wasn't the political will. He just couldn't turn that corner. And so one of the things that I find so remarkable about George is that rather than stopping there, he actually went to Washington, D.C. and attempted to do on the federal level what he couldn't do on the state level, which, if, of course, is just exponentially more difficult. And so in D.C., he tried to get a federal bill passed in order to protect lands, and when that failed, then he was also part of a group called the Ecologist Union, and that was a loose band of academics who believed in protecting natural areas but really didn't know how to do it. But he convinced them to transform that organization into the Nature Conservancy. And this is where George really started to shine, because what he insisted upon doing was putting this infrastructure into place to make sure that this, again, loose band of ecologists could grow into a national scale organization. And that's what he did in the Conservancy. He did that for about 10 years, again, putting into place these solid bones, which has allowed the Conservancy to grow into the largest conservation organization in the world today.
Yeah, can you talk about how that those early days of the Nature Conservancy went? How was it structured? How did he build it that it lasted to be the huge organization that it is today?
Well, this was in the early 1950s, and among the things that he put in place was what's described as the Conservancy's vaunted chapter system. There is a chapter in every state in the nation and now across the world. So he was visionary in having this really strong dynamic between having a chapter in every state, which was responsible for the local projects, but then guiding all of those efforts at the national organization. He was also very adept at building a strong membership base, a very large membership base, believing that if you got a lot of people interested and supportive of nature, that would bring in more money, it would get more political support. So those kinds of things he insisted on putting into place. Not everyone agreed with that, which made for some interesting tensions in the early years of the Nature Conservancy. But even after George left the Conservancy, those things stayed in place. And again, they are the foundation upon which the Conservancy has built its great success.
And how did he make the case that these smaller areas were just as worthy of preservation as some of these huge epic landscapes like John Muir was working on in California? How did he get the same attention for, you know, a rock prairie?
Yeah, that was kind of a tough sell, because some of these natural lands were as small as a prairie. Scattered throughout Illinois and some other Midwestern states, for instance, there are pioneer cemeteries. And actually, Aldo Leopold writes about this in a Sand County Almanac. This little, almost forgotten patch of land where native plants have grown up because it was a cemetery that only had a short lifespan. So it's a difficult case to make because it's not the big scenic grandeur. But what George was adept at doing was letting people know that even these small parcels of land contained a wealth of biological diversity, plants and animals. And I liken them to being so many Noah's Arks, especially in Illinois here upon a sea of corn and soybeans. So in Illinois, you've got 75% of the state, which is pretty much, again, corn and soybeans. But amongst those corn and soybean fields, you have these amazing little arcs of rich biodiversity. You could have 350 prairie plants in a couple acres, and the native birds and mammals and insects that those lands support. Eventually, that actually excited people's imagination, and they supported that. And today, there are 500 nature preserves in Illinois. There's some 600-700 in Wisconsin. It became a really attractive idea for a lot of people.
So if it weren't for George Fell, it sounds as though Illinois and certainly Wisconsin would look a lot different today.
They definitely would. Throughout the Midwest, really. And it's interesting that in the Midwest, where most of the land was gobbled up for farming or development, this is where the natural areas movement really started. It was anchored here in the Midwest. We who had the least, I think most of them appreciated, and certainly George did, that we needed to protect these last bastions of biological diversity. And again, in Illinois, and I use that as a reference point, even though the total amount of land is very small compared, of course, to the size of the state, these little arcs contain a disproportionate number of the rare, threatened, and endangered species in the entire Midwest.
And Arthur, before I let you go, do you think we're going to start to know his name?
Well, I really hope so. George Fell is one of those guys whose name really should be up there with the Aldo Leopolds and the John Muirs. He created an entire movement, an incredibly important chapter in the history of conservation, and part of the reason was to remind us about this, but also to inspire and surface the next George Fell to lead us in new creative dynamic ways for preserving lands far into the future.
Arthur, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Arthur Melville Pearson, author of Force of Nature, George Fell, founder of the Natural Areas Movement.
Income inequality has been a big issue in recent years, and the idea that the wealthiest Americans have too much power in politics helped drive support for Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump in last year's presidential campaign.
Our next guest says economic inequality poses a fundamental threat to representative government in the United States, and the Constitution didn't prepare us to deal with that problem.
Ganesh Sitaraman joins us now. He's an associate professor of law at Vanderbilt University. He's the author of the new book, The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic. Ganesh, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to go back to the writing of our Constitution. You point out that a lot of governments, republics, when they've created constitutions, they are trying to reconcile differences between rich and poor and kind of balance those tensions. You said things were different for the founding fathers when they came up with our Constitution. How so?
Well, that's exactly right. So for most of the history of governments, from the ancient Greeks on to the 18th century and the founding of America, people were very worried about the problem of economic inequality. They worried that the rich would oppress the poor, or that the poor would try to confiscate the wealth of the rich. And the result would be strife, violence, and even revolutions. And so to deal with this instability in society, what they did is they built economic class right into the structure of government. So in England, you have the House of Lords for the wealthy and the House of Commons for everybody else. In ancient Rome, you have a patrician senate for the wealthy and a tribune of the plebs, of plebeians, for the poor and for everybody else. Our Constitution isn't like that. We don't have a tribune of the plebs. We don't have property requirements to be a senator or a congressman or even to be president of the United States. Our Constitution is radically different, and it's radically different because at the time, people believed America was surprisingly economically equal and that it would continue to be economically equal throughout our history.
You say they believe that, and when you look, and to put an asterisk on it, when you look at the white men who were voting at that period of time, was there more or less economic equality or less inequality than we saw elsewhere?
So there was, and part of the way we have to think about this is we have to imagine that we're back in the 1780s. And what's striking about this time is America is really just a small country, a set of sparsely populated settlements along the Atlantic coast. And what's striking about the new nation is how different it is from Europe. Unlike Europe, there's no feudalism in America. Unlike Europe, there's no hereditary aristocracy in America. The richest people in America, your George Washingtons, who have these plantations and big houses like Mount Vernon, are just nothing in comparison to the dukes and duchesses of England with their gigantic marble palaces. And America had one other thing. It had all this land to the west, which meant that white men, you mentioned it was only white men at the time, could become landowners and have a share and a stake in being part of the middle class as independent yeoman farmers. And so that was the idea on and the reality on which our system was based. And there's actually some economic historians who've gone back and tried to collect data on this time period. And what they find is that in 1774, right on the cusp of the American Revolution, and even including slavery, America was the most equal place in the world, and in fact was more equal than America is today.
Now there's a fear, and you're right, some of the founders wrote that this is great now, but if people start getting too rich, we're going to have problems. I want to fast forward a little to some of those problems. After the Civil War, rise of big corporations, large groups of factory workers on the other end of the scale, what kind of tensions did that start to create, and why didn't that Constitution we have really meet that crisis?
So it's exactly as you said. In the Gilded Age in the late 19th century, there were some big shifts. We moved from an agricultural economy and an artisanal economy to an economy of wage workers in factories. This was the big developments of industrialization. We had the closing of the frontier and the shift to people moving into cities, another big change in this time period. And these things put serious pressure on our economic system because the idea of a country that had land ownership that was spread across and that would be the dominant form of wealth was shifting in the age of the factory where most people didn't have land. They were wage workers. So that was a fundamental change. And people were very worried that the increasing inequality that was emerging in this time period because of corporations, their shareholders, and the owners of these big enterprises having more and more wealth, that this would threaten our republic. It would threaten our constitutional system. And they saw this in terms of bribery, which was happening rampantly across state legislatures and in the federal government as well. And they worried about how this was skewing policies to support the wealthy. And so populists and progressives tried to take action to change our constitutional system and our economic system in order to revive the basic understanding of what it meant to have a representative democracy.
Talking to Ganesh Sitaraman, his new book is The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic. And then, Ganesh, you write that the progressives and ultimately the New Dealers did help flatten things out and kind of avert this crisis of either a wealthy oligarchs taking over or a rebellion against those oligarchs leading to tyranny.
That's exactly right. So in the populist and progressive eras around the turn of the 20th century, we really did two things as a country. The first is that we tried to reform the economy. We invented antitrust laws to break up big concentrations of corporate power. We passed a constitutional amendment for an income tax so people with a greater ability to pay would pay more. On the political side, we passed the first campaign finance regulations. We also passed a constitutional amendment for the direct election of U.S. senators rather than the selection of U.S. senators by state legislatures where there was a lot of corruption going on. And those changes were designed to create both an economic democracy and a political democracy in America. And they were largely successful, such that by the end of World War II, coming out of World War II, we ended up with an era of great prosperity and growth and a rising middle class.
I've been fast-forwarding through history a little bit because I wanted to get to today. Take us from where you just were, you know, not equal economically across the country, but relatively flat to where we are now. What happened? How did things start diverging?
Well, so what happened is in the period after World War II, we really invested in the kinds of things that would allow for a large and growing middle class. On the one hand, we had regulations in place that curtailed the kind of bad behavior at the very top. We had Glass-Steagall separating investment banking from depository banking. We had a Securities and Exchange Commission to go after bad actors in the financial sector. But we also invested in building a middle class through the GI Bill, which sent a generation to college, infrastructure spending like the highways, which both created jobs and expanded commerce across the country. We did these things to build the middle class, and it really worked for that period of time. After about 30, 40 years, starting in the late 70s and really coming into full force in the 80s, we really moved in a different direction in terms of policy. We moved to cutting taxes for the wealthiest people, deregulating a lot of these sectors. And over time, what we saw was that there was increasing inequality, and ultimately the great crash of 2008 came at the end of this long era. And so that's the place where we are today, is still in the wake of the economic crash and the Great Recession. We're in a period where there's rising inequality, where people feel increasingly insecure, and where the middle class is shrinking and is increasingly anxious about being able to provide for their future. And it's partly a function of these economic policies that we've undertaken over the last 30 years, but partly a function of what those economic policies do to our political system, which enables the wealthiest people and corporations to set policies that benefit themselves instead of benefiting the common good.
Right. There's that fear of the founders there, that if we had this class of really wealthy people, they'd have too much power over government. Do they? And if so, how does that play out?
Yeah. So, you know, John Taylor, a senator from Virginia in 1814, said that when the rich plunder the poor, it is slow and legal. And what he meant by that is what happens is when you have this kind of wealthy class of people, they use the laws to their advantage and they design the laws in their advantage, and that it just creates this kind of vicious cycle. One commentator calls it the doom loop of oligarchy, in which you just have reinforcing wealth and power. And that's not what it means to have a representative government or a representative democracy.
You mentioned progressive campaign finance reform from about a century ago, actually. Big changes lately, and you say that's due to kind of novel interpretations of the First Amendment starting in the last 30, 40 years. What happened?
So one of the things that's happened is that we've taken, the Supreme Court has taken a narrow approach to what the government is allowed to regulate as money in our campaign system. And the approach used to be that the kinds of things that would distort the political marketplace, the marketplace of ideas, could be regulated. And increasingly what the court has done is said that really they're only going to allow campaign finance regulations if there's bribery or the appearance of quid pro quo bribery. That's a much narrower kind of regulation, becomes much harder to regulate the amount of money going into politics. And this is a really perverse thing. And it's perverse not just because there's a lot of bribery going on. In most cases, I don't think there's a lot of direct bribery going on in Congress. The real problem that we have in Congress is if you spend all your time raising money, most of the time what you're doing is you're talking to very, very wealthy people, and you're hearing the concerns of very, very wealthy people. And that skews your views if you're a member of Congress to support the things that the people who you're spending your time with believe, rather than you being out there talking to ordinary constituents in your district and hearing from them what their real concerns are.
Ganesh Sitaraman is with us now talking about income inequality in the United States and how it could affect the stability of the country. He's an associate professor of law at Vanderbilt University. We're talking about his new book. It's The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Income Inequality Threatens Our Republic.
And you can join our conversation. Do you think income inequality is a threat to the stability of the country? Why or why not? And what do you think should be done to alleviate income inequality? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation about the growing economic divide in the United States and why it might threaten the stability of the country. Ganesh Sitaraman is with us. He's an associate professor of law at Vanderbilt University and the author of The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution.
You can join the conversation. What questions do you have about economic inequality and the impact they might have on politics? What do you think could be done to solve the problem? Is there a political figure you look to as trying to solve this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. So Ganesh, growing economic inequality, the worry that either the richest people are in charge of everything or everybody else has a revolution of some sort or brings a tyrant in to take their place. How worried are you at this time in American history?
Well, I think we have real concern to be worried, and it's because that this kind of change happens on the side of leaning toward oligarchy, not in one big moment. We don't revise the Constitution to say we're now an oligarchy. It happens slowly. It happens without us really noticing. And one day we wake up and we don't have the kind of free society, the republic that we wish we had and that we were supposed to have. So I think this is worrying. And I think it's worrying because the numbers that we see today about the amount of wealth going to the richest people in this country are getting wider, and they're extremely concerning. They're at rates that we haven't seen since before the Great Depression, and that's a big challenge to our society. So I'm worried about it, and I think this in some ways is the real constitutional crisis that we face right now, and it's one that can't be solved in 1 year or with one Congress or one bill. It's something that's going to take a long time for us to work through.
We'll get to some possible solutions in a few. Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jane is with us in Fond du Lac. Jane, hi.
Hi. I want to agree with your guest that income inequality is the constitutional crisis we're facing, because that's the nub of everything. And I think that this phase we're in now began when Reagan first busted the Air Traffic Controllers Union. And I said at that time, you've just seen the beginning of the end of the middle class. And unfortunately, my prediction is borne out to be true. And I was hopeful that in this administration now, which I thought was going to be a Democratic administration and possibly control of the Senate, we could continue to unravel some of what has been done since 1982, 83. And now I'm more frightened than ever because the swamp is deeper than ever. They're talking even within states to rewrite the United States Constitution.
Jane, I want to jump in because you've given us a lot to talk about there. Ganesh, first of all, the decline of unions, anti-union efforts, Jane says, part of the problem with inequality. Is it?
Yes, Jane's exactly right about this. I mean, unions are one of the most effective institutions in American public policy for advancing the interests of working class people. Across our history, unions have been at the forefront of fighting for working class people, not just members of unions also, by the way, but all working class people, whether or not they were in a union. And in fact, some of the studies show that of all the interest groups in Washington, the only ones that consistently advocate for the interests of working class people in this country are unions. And so the deliberate assault on the right to be able to join a union in this country over the last 30 years or so is a real problem because it threatens the balance that we have between institutions that support the interests of working class people and many other institutions that exist in the country that support more wealthy people, whether that's corporate trade associations or others. Unions are really a core part of how we built the middle class here.
Jane, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Alice on the line in Sheboygan. Alice, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call in and speak about what occurred after World War II with the rise of the middle class from all these farm boys that got to go to college and how that changed our country. And lo and behold, if many of them didn't go into engineering and become engineers, and I wish, for another rise of the middle class, and I'm afraid some promises were made by our current president to people who will never see the middle class.
Alice, thanks for the call. You had mentioned, Ganesh, the GI Bill. College funding, college education costs, big topic now. Do you think we can recreate some of what Alice says was the success of that post-World War II education initiative?
Yeah, throughout our history, education has been one of the important tickets to the middle class for people. In the 19th century, we created the land-grant colleges so that people all across the country would be able to get a college education. In the 20th century, we had the GI Bill, sending a generation to college. We had the National Defense Education Act, which created college loans to let people go to college. In the last few decades, though, what we've seen is skyrocketing college costs and debt being pushed onto and held by students. And this is a real problem because it means that young people are deeply worried and unable to really live as adults because they're highly burdened by these huge debt loads. It's a problem for their parents who worry about putting their kids through college. This is a serious challenge for our economy. It's also a challenge for building the middle class when we have all of this debt being pushed pushed onto our youngest people who are entering the workforce. So I think this is a huge problem, and it's one of the things that we really need to work on right now is making college more affordable, if not free altogether.
Alex, thanks for the call. Ganesh Sitaraman is with us now, author of The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic. Time for one more call. Aaron is with us in Oshkosh. Aaron, hi.
Yes, hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you think?
Well, very simple. I'll be succinct. Number one, citizenship aside, people need to be proactive in their citizenship. They need to be involved. We have Social Security cards. That's our federal identification number. Therefore, people should think of it kind of like a stock. We have a vested interest in this country as citizens, as stockholders, and change does not happen on its own. Change happens via sacrifice. We as a people, as a mass, as citizens, need to actively put ourselves online and get involved, or else nothing will change.
Aaron, thanks for the call. And Ganesh, that's a good segue. I wanted to talk about possible solutions here. If so much more power is being concentrated in the hands of the wealthiest, what is the ordinary citizen to do to change things?
Well, I think Aaron's exactly right about how we all need to be involved. And one of the exciting things I discovered in doing the research for this book is that people throughout our history were engaged in a sustained way at the grassroots level over many, many years. It wasn't just one march or one election, but throughout the populist and progressive era, which was the last time we really confronted levels of inequality like we're seeing today, people were very, very active. There were strike waves across the country. There were mass protests. There was lots of action to try to get change in government. And that was necessary to be able to allow the people who were in government who wanted to make change to have the wind in their sails, to have the force behind them, to be able to push that change through our political process, which is designed to be difficult to get anything through. And that's what it takes. It's going to take a combination of leadership who wants to make change, but also a grassroots movement to force them to make change.
But as you lay things out with political influence, the wealthiest people are involved in selecting candidates, funding candidates, talking to candidates, lobbying candidates, and you cite some research in the book saying they have a lot more access to politicians, a lot bigger voice than the rest of Americans. How to overcome that?
Yeah, so this is one of the deep, perverse ironies of the system is the people you need to win over are the very ones who are being influenced by the wealthiest people in the country. Now, I think what's most instructive is how we got past the constitutional amendment to have the direct election of senators, because in order to do this, they had to get the Senate to agree to this amendment. And all these senators had been picked under the old model by the state legislatures. And they also had to get the state legislatures to agree to give up their power to pick senators, which is not something that people like to do. They don't want to give up their power. And so how did they do this 100 years ago? The way they did it was people went out and they asked their legislators, they asked everybody running for office to pledge to support the direct election approach, and that they would refuse to vote for people unless they did that. And that was the kind of action that it took over multiple years to try to build that movement. And when you had enough people who had pledged to do it, it happened. I think that's the kind of thing we need today is real grassroots action to push candidates to support the kind of things that will help rebuild our middle class, get money out of our political system, and really make this government a republic again.
We'll leave it there. Ganesh, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's been great to be here.
Ganesh Sitaraman is an associate professor of law at Vanderbilt University. He's the author of the new book we've been talking about, The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic. He joins us today to talk about the rising tide of economic inequality in the United States and the effects he's worried it may have on our political system, on the future of representative government here in the United States. Still time for you to share your thoughts on this very big topic. You can head over to the Central Time Facebook page, or if you're very succinct, tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Do I do?
The voice of jazz legend Ella Fitzgerald there, born on this day in 1917, so this would be your 100th birthday. And Veronica, you're a singer, and you're a fan and an admirer.
I've always been a huge admirer of Ella Fitzgerald. As a singer, she's so nimble. Her voice is so fluid, she can turn on a dime. I think we're going to hear an instance in a song where she forgets a verse when she's singing in Berlin. It doesn't stop her. She makes up words, she scats, the audience loves it, and she has a special magic that she brings. It's incredible.
I didn't end up pulling that bit of Mac the Knife, I think it was. But yeah, it sounded like you like a live performance of hers in Berlin. And it sounds like, in addition to having this amazing, nimble voice, she's just a lot of fun.
Right. You know, it seems like even when she's singing about dire topics, heartbreak, Mac the Knife, forgetting verses, she's always got a sense of humor. So she doesn't quite have that pathos, but she's got this unforgettable voice, which is absolutely one of a kind. Absolutely, Ella.
Well, let that voice speak for itself a little more. Ella Fitzgerald, 100th, what would be her 100th birthday. This is Central Time. But now all is gone. Gone is wrapped up.